Excuse me, everyone, again. I'd like to introduce our guest today, and I think he is certainly well known to quite a few of you here. So it's welcoming back to Adelaide, Brian Martin. He's been up in the territory for 2.5 years now. We know Brian Martin as one of Australia's most eminent jurists. He's been a central figure in some of South Australia's and indeed Australia's most notorious criminal cases. As the state's top prosecutor, he put behind bars the murder of Evan Spencer von Einem. More recently, of course, as a judge, he presided over the Snowtown murders, and after being appointed Chief Justice of the Northern Territory, he sentenced Bradley Murdoch to life for the murder of English tourist Peter Falconio. By the way, I think Joanne Lee's own account of that infamous outback killing will be published next month. But it's the allegations of widespread child abuse, child sexual abuse in Aboriginal communities that has again thrust the Northern Territory's justice system into the headlines. In May, Chief Justice Martin admitted he was wrong in placing too much emphasis on Aboriginal customary law. It related to a month's jail sentence he gave an Aboriginal elder for child rape. The case has given added weight to the widening debate across the nation on how to deal with these shocking crimes. Needless to say, politicians are setting their own agenda, so no doubt the issue will assume even greater importance in the months and years ahead. So it's against this background that I'm delighted to welcome Chief Justice Martin to speak to us today. Please make him welcome.
Well, I might need the water, bearing in mind the nature of the audience. Thank you for the invitation to join you today. I must say there is some fear and trepidation, not just because I'm here in front of a large number of the media, but some of you actually have long memories, I know, and remember me back in the younger days. Look, I'll be delighted to take questions afterwards, but I'm taking no historical questions at all. This is a very interesting time to be attending a gathering such as this, because as an Australia-wide community, we are at a critical stage of the evolution of our values and the development of our policies with respect to our system of criminal justice. This evolution has followed the wanton destruction of lives in 2001. Prior to that occasion, terrorism had existed in various forms throughout the world, but we in Australia had been relatively isolated from the impacts of the terrorism. The destruction of the Twin Towers and those lives began a revolution in thinking in our part of the world about how to deal with terrorism, and that revolution, of course, gained impetus with Bali bombings and other events. Today we are experiencing a vigorous debate about where to strike that precarious balance between laws which will best achieve the objective of protecting our community while avoiding the catastrophe of an innocent person being wrongly convicted, and in addition, while protecting individuals against the unjustified use of the power of the state through various law enforcement agencies. We have entered a new era. The state is claiming special powers are required to combat terrorism. These are powers which override rights we have always regarded as fundamental to our democratic way of life. Rights so fundamental that as a community we have taken them for granted. In the United States of America, these special powers include detaining suspects offshore in Cuba. Whatever David Hicks did or did not do, and we have no idea because evidence has not been presented, it is totally foreign to our understanding of the proper treatment of citizens in a civilized community to incarcerate a person for many years without charge and without independent judicial supervision in the conditions to which Mr. Hicks has been subjected. As Fyodor Dostoevsky, the Russian author, said in the 1800s, A society should be judged not by how it treats its outstanding citizens, but by how it treats its prisoners. In America, this belief in the need for special powers is so strong that it has apparently extended to secret prisons run by the CIA and to alternative interrogation techniques. And that is a quote. What a delightful euphemism for torture. And of course, these techniques are justified by the political leaders of that country on the ground that they unearthed information that prevented further terrorist attacks against the American homeland. The ends justify the means. I wonder whether such techniques would have been justified if they'd unearthed no useful information and if they had in fact been applied to an innocent person. In Australia, we now have control orders which severely curtail the rights of an individual to move freely about our community. Make no mistake, these control orders are far removed in principle and in effect from bail conditions or restraining orders. Bail conditions only exist while the person is charged with a crime. They cease if the person is acquitted. Restraining orders are made on complaint and on evidence satisfying a court that there is a real risk of harm to an individual or that individual's property. They are directed at restraining conduct toward an individual. They do not otherwise restrict the right of a citizen to move freely about the community. Should we in Australia support secret security prisons or torture or something less? Should we support control orders and other features of the terror legislation? Or should we insist on maintaining those rights previously regarded as fundamental? Where should we strike the balance? The debate that is occurring is a healthy debate. It is an essential feature of our democracy that such a debate involving polarised views, and they are polarised, can occur freely and openly. What we need, however, is a debate without half truths and spin doctors. Political interests should be set aside. It is a debate that requires strength of leadership and a willingness of our leaders to stand up for fundamental rights, which might not be perceived as popular, and to lead the discussion in a way that ensures that we do not override fundamental rights for populist political reasons. As a society, we need to tread warily and weigh very carefully the competing interests to ensure that we are not panicked into measures that we will later regret. Please understand that in mentioning these changes and the evaluation of the debate, I am not expressing personal views. I do not intend to enter the fray and discuss the merits of the various views. I mention these matters because they provide a setting for the mood in the Australian political scene and wider community about law and order generally. That mood has had an impact upon the debate in the area I have been asked to discuss, that is, the place of customary law in our criminal justice system. Let me begin with a few observations about the difficulties associated with Aboriginal customary law. I will try to raise issues for your consideration. Nanette Rogers of the Alice Springs Office of the Northern Territory Director of Public Prosecutions recently highlighted, and very properly so, the appalling violence, including sexual violence, that exists in some Aboriginal communities. And I must stress some Aboriginal communities. It has been said with considerable justification that within such communities there is a culture of violence by Aboriginal men against Aboriginal women and children. We should, however, be careful about the use of the word culture. The type of alcohol-fueled violence with which the criminal courts are constantly concerned is not presented to the court in the sentencing submissions as in any way related to or justified or condoned by traditional Aboriginal customary law. It is not advanced as part of an accepted culture, nor is the abuse of young boys as part of an initiation ever presented to a court as truly related to traditional culture or customary law. As many Aboriginal leaders have recently pointed out, genuine traditional Aboriginal culture and customary law does not support or condone these types of violence and abuse. We should also bear in mind that Aboriginal customary law is not a single set of laws that has or does apply to all Aboriginal communities across Australia. It is a bit like suggesting that before the days of the European Union, there was a single set of laws that governed Europe. No doubt there are common themes, but there are also significant differences across this huge continent. I do not pretend to be able to even scratch the surface, but I and others gained some small insight into the operation of the laws of certain clans of the Yolngu people through a visit to Elko Island last year at the invitation of the clans involved. This particular clan nation had held its Nara, the Chamber of Law, and we were given a very small insight into the workings of their legal system. In substance, their parliament had been in operation. Not very much different from an Anglo-Saxon and European parliament involved in education, social structures, commerce, law. This clan had historically and still has an independent system of determining disputes between parties and determining if crimes have been committed. They appoint people independent of the parties to make the investigation, to reach decisions, and to determine and inflict punishment. The important underlying element was and is the independence of the investigator, trier of fact, and deliverer of punishment. Now that's the system they had operational there. There are other areas where that system is broken down. There are other areas where, for example, the families of the victim might inflict the punishment. Now that's not what this clan had in terms of their traditional system. It must also be remembered that like Anglo-Saxon laws, the customary laws of the clan nations have evolved and changed over the years in the face of the operation of the wider laws of Australia and the changing world in which they live. For example, in many communities, traditional punishments, which are unacceptable under territory and state laws, have either been abolished or modified to a significant degree in order to comply with the wider law. We must not overlook the importance of traditional laws to many of these communities and the people within them, not just in connection with crime and punishment, but in connection with the fundamental social structures of these communities. In addition, just like many millions around the world who are bound together by their religious beliefs and laws, Aboriginal spiritual beliefs developed over thousands of years have bound their communities together and given Aboriginal persons a purpose in life and a place in their world. But their beliefs are challenged by the new world order and its laws. It is a difficult transitional period, and in comparison with the same transition that has occurred in other parts of the world, it is happening in a very short space of time. We should not underestimate the difficulty. I went for a walk this morning along the banks of the Torrens, away from the Hyatt. It is beautifully manicured and ordered. Everything seems to have a purpose. And I watched people going to their work or wherever they were going. They appeared to have a purpose. This is an ordered world, but we must remember that within our world here in Australia, we have a large number of people who live in a world that is not ordered. They live in a world where they have no purpose. Their self-esteem has been destroyed. It's not a simple problem. It is a difficult problem, and for the territory in particular. I think the largest percentage of population of Aboriginal people in a state other than the territory is about 3%. In the territory it's 33%. A third of a very small population, the territory is about 200,000. A third are Aboriginal people. A lot of those live in very remote areas. a significant percentage of them don't speak English, or English is their third language, and a very large percentage of them, even if they speak the language, they do not understand what we would regard today as ordinary concepts. Now, this is Australia, and we know you've seen reports about the appalling conditions in which they live. But this is Australia today, and this is the reality that lies behind trying to reconcile the laws, and for some of these people, in trying to comply with the wider laws of this country. So can the wider legal system coexist with Aboriginal customary law? The answer to that question must be yes. In many respects, they already coexist without undue difficulty. Traditional punishment is a good example. Courts upholding and administering the wider law cannot and do not condone or facilitate unlawful violence. However, adult offenders can consent to a certain level of lawful violence. That is, it's a bit like the boxers. They consent to being punched. If it is the wish of a community, including the victim and the victim's family, and if an adult offender consents to the infliction of specified punishment, provided those punishments are not unlawful according to the wider law, that punishment can be carried out and will be taken into account by the criminal court in arriving at an appropriate sentence. It might just be sending a young offender out bush to be taking lessons from the elders, or to be receiving some form of physical punishment which is quite lawful. It does not mean that traditional punishment has usurped or overridden the role of the criminal court. But the fact that the offender has undergone punishment that accords with the wishes of the victim and the community and the offender's own wishes is relevant in determining the appropriate level of punishment under the wider system of criminal justice. There is nothing unusual about this. It is not a case of applying two laws. That is a glib, simple, misleading political answer. Under that single law, the court takes into account numerous circumstances, including whether an offender has, for one reason or another, suffered punishment following the commission of the crime. It might be financial through the loss of employment or damage to a business. It might be the breakdown of a family relationship or the public loss of reputation. A victim or a victim's friends may have administered physical retribution. These punishments are taken into account in the same way as punishment administered according to a particular customary law. The weight to be given to these forms of punishment varies according to many circumstances, including the seriousness of the offending and the severity of that punishment. Within Aboriginal communities, this form of restorative justice can be very effective in achieving not only punishment of the offender, retribution and protection of the community through deterrence, but in satisfaction for the victim and the victim's family. We hear much these days about the interests of the victim and whether the court does take sufficient account of the interests of the victim, or whether sentences do. This form of restorative justice can be, and is frequently, a very effective form of punishment from the victim's perspective. The other potential way in which Aboriginal customary law has a role to play concerns the moral culpability of the offender. And this is the area in which, as Mr. Herding has told you, I got the balance wrong. By the way, it was not rape. It was unlawful sexual intercourse, but that's another issue. That doesn't change the fact that I got it wrong. In terms of moral culpability, if the unlawful conduct was carried out in the belief that it was, by reason of customary law, lawful and appropriate, such a belief formed for that reason relates directly to the moral culpability of the offender. How much weight can be given to the influence of this customary law on the moral culpability must depend upon the circumstances of the offending, and particularly the gravity of the crime. This will range from very little weight in case of extremely serious crimes to perhaps quite significant weight when minor crimes are committed. It is a matter of balance. Again, this is not to create a special law for Aboriginal people, nor is it to permit ignorance of the law to excuse criminal conduct. The one law requires the court to take into account the moral culpability of the offender in arriving at an appropriate sentence. If there is a factor which reduces moral culpability, then of course the court must take it into account. The source of that factor might be in the mental state of a particular offender, perhaps through some form of mental infirmity. It might be the immaturity of the offender. But the fact that one offender is able to claim a degree of leniency for some such reason and another offender is not, does not mean that they are being treated differently under different laws. Similarly, moral culpability might be affected by cultural factors influencing the behaviour of persons from countries outside Australia. Insults of a particular type hurled at an Anglo-Saxon person raised in Australia without any impact whatsoever might, in other circumstances and directed to people of different cultural backgrounds, be regarded as highly insulting and provocative. A person of a particular cultural background might be influenced in their behaviour by the degree of insulting provocation in a way which would have no impact or no influence on another person. Again, it goes to the moral culpability. And it might be something as simple as two people having an argument in a street and one hurls an insult and the other reacts spontaneously and punches them and breaks their nose. It doesn't necessarily have to involve a crime of a very serious nature. We need to think about this when we start talking about changing the law and reducing the discretion of the judges. It's not a question of someone being treated differently under a different law. It is a one law. Ultimately, the critical question for a court is to balance the competing factors and get the balance right. Well, what's gone wrong? Why does this violence exist? Have the authorities failed people in these communities, particularly women and children? Again, speaking very broadly, the answer to the last question must be yes. We have a totally unacceptable level of violence, particularly violence against women and children, in sections of our community. It does not matter what section of the community we are discussing. If women and children are being violently abused, it means that we, as a community, have failed in our responsibility to ensure that all members of our community, particularly those who are vulnerable, are able to live a peaceful coexistence free from crime generally, but more especially free from crimes of violence. But to say that we have failed is not to condemn any particular part of our system. The causes of violence, including sexual violence, throughout Australia and in particular in these Aboriginal communities, are wide and varied. Attacking these causes includes addressing issues such as loss of self-respect, employment, health, education, living conditions, social infrastructure and law and order. A particularly difficult area to address is the emerging and disturbing influence of pornography upon male persons in these communities for whom no boundaries of appropriate behaviour have ever been set. Just think about that. Think about young children running wild. Running wild is not the right expression. Within Aboriginal communities, children are free to roam and play in and around the streets, to go into other people's houses. That's just the way they live. If big screens are playing pornography, and these children are watching the pornography, and if they are at the same time not being given any direction in their lives, any instructions about what is or is not appropriate behaviour, and if they are living year after year with the violence that is occurring within these communities, how surprising is it that when they reach the age of 16, 17, or even earlier, or a bit older, that they in fact themselves commit these types of offences, of violence? They've never had the boundaries set. And it is impossible as a sentencing court to ignore that sort of dysfunctional environment in which these offenders have grown up. And nobody in their right mind should suggest that we should ignore those types of things. That's straight off the topic. That's not Aboriginal culture, but that's giving you a little insight into what is being dealt with day after day by the criminal courts in the Northern Territory in particular. There may be features of Aboriginal customary law and traditions which have had a role to play in developing a tolerance within some Aboriginal communities to violence, and in creating what can very loosely be described as a culture of violence surrounding it. Vulnerable victims and others need assistance to overcome the intense pressure to remain silent. So what's the role of the criminal court? For many years, across Australia, the courts have repeatedly condemned alcohol-fueled violence in these communities, but it is well recognised, and it was said first, I think, by President Fitzgerald when he was sitting in the Queensland Court, the law is a blunt social instrument, and there is a limit to the effectiveness of sentences of imprisonment in preventing this type of violence. At times, sentences have been too lenient, but it would be naive and simply wrong to suggest that if heavier penalties had been imposed, the level of violence would be less than it is today. It is wrong to suggest that it would be able to prevent the continuation of the violence. Blind, drunk offenders who have grown up in violent, deprived and dysfunctional circumstances do not think rationally or at all about the consequences of their actions. What of the future? There can be no doubt that establishing law and order in these communities at appropriate levels is an important consideration. The penalties have already increased without significant impact. Courts will continue to do what they can. However, penalties do not address the root causes of the violence about which we are also concerned. Directing courts to ignore customary law considerations will, in effect, operate unfairly upon a relatively small number of offenders in Aboriginal communities and upon other offenders whose criminal conduct is influenced by their cultural background or beliefs. Significantly, it will have absolutely no impact whatsoever on the root causes of crimes in the affected communities. In particular, as the vast majority of crimes of violence in these communities are fueled by alcohol and have nothing to do with customary law, abolishing considerations of customary law will have no effect whatsoever on this violence which is so prevalent. May I quote an article by Professor Larissa Berendt, Professor of Law and Indigenous Studies at the University of Technology, Sydney. The proposal to legislate to exclude customary law from the factors that can be considered in sentencing is dangerous. Like any attempt to restrict a judicial officer's capacity to weigh up all the relevant factors when sentencing, the inability to consider customary law at all will impede the capacity to ensure that a just sentence is given in each particular circumstance before the court. It is also a serious infringement on the judicial process by the legislature, and as such has implications for the principle of the separation of powers. But pointing the finger at the judiciary is an easy way for politicians to grandstand and score quick political soundbites. Judges who hear criminal cases where violence has been committed against Aboriginal women and children are dealing with the symptoms of a far more complex social problem. And it is the politicians, not the judiciary, who have the most power to profoundly influence the root causes of cyclical violence and the breakdown of the social fabric in Aboriginal communities. If I may say so, wise words. So, let's stop sitting in comfortable seats in capital cities, blaming the lenient sentences and rushing to promote the simplistic idea of abolishing customary law considerations. Let's get to work at the fundamental level of attacking the root causes. And in particular, as a community, let's provide appropriate facilities and personnel to achieve rehabilitation of offenders while they are incarcerated. Now, I'm well aware of where I am standing, that is, in which state I'm standing, and I'm well aware of the recent controversies that have attended the court's versus the politicians. So let me say right at the outset, I am not criticising the South Australian government or any other government for being tough on crime. Nor am I suggesting that anyone should apologise for being tough on crime. That is a matter for policy for governments to determine. You may gather I'm a little tired of hearing the answer to the debate. We won't apologise for being tough on crime. We won't apologise for trying to protect women and children. One might be tempted to ask, who is asking you? What I'm doing, these are questions of policy for the government to determine. What I'm doing is urging governments across Australia to attack the fundamental causes and to put the necessary resources into rehabilitation. We want and need offenders rehabilitated. All but a very few are released. Longer sentences will not in themselves achieve rehabilitation. In many instances, they will have the reverse effect of hardening the offender into a recidivist with little prospect of hope or of a lawful future. An extra few years will not deter others from committing crimes. We have, as a community, we have to address these critical areas in practical ways with the necessary funds and personnel. And just speaking of necessary personnel and addressing the problems in these Aboriginal communities, permit me to advance a practical idea for attracting the necessary personnel. It is not my idea. It is an idea that my wife Lee has been pushing for some years, and I mean years. And I note it was recently suggested in the context of another area. Many of these communities are in remote and harsh areas. Working there can be very difficult. It's not an attractive proposition for many young graduates. These communities desperately need teachers, nurses, doctors, social workers, tradespersons, and we need to offer real incentive to attract young graduates to these communities. The suggestion is that graduates who are prepared to work within the communities for a reasonable period will have their entire HECS debt waived, and that the waiver of the HECS debt will not be regarded as taxable income. There's two parts to it. Waive the debt, and it's not regarded as taxable income. It might be said that it'll put people out in these communities without experience. Some will criticise the proposal for that reason. Is it better to have a young doctor who is fully trained but with little experience than no doctor? And in these days, of course, there are links through satellite communications between many of these communities and larger centres where the training can be given and the advice can be given by video. I urge our leaders not to react negatively to new ideas and to think outside the square in positive ways. Now, speaking of negativity leads me to another topic, and that relates, that's if I'm allowed to go a little longer. That relates to the media and the courts, more particularly the criminal courts. It's common knowledge that the courts and the media have always had an uneasy relationship, and I'm not going to try and explore the reasons for that. I've probably upset both sides badly. It does not help, however, when the News Limited chairman and chief executive, John Hartigan, accuses the judiciary of being secretive and self-serving. That was in the context of suppression orders. I need to emphasise, courts are not secretive. Almost everything is done in open court, including the giving of evidence, which is suppressed. Rarely is a court closed to the public. Other than on rare occasions, courts are not self-serving. When a court places restraints upon the media through suppression orders, it is not for the self-interest of the court. While the media have a legitimate point that some judicial officers are too cautious and grant suppression orders too readily, those orders are not made for self-interest. They are made in the interests of the individual before the court and the community at large. Again, it's a matter of balancing the two interests. I have used the observation of Mr. Hartigan as an example because it does typify the negative attitude that pervades reporting of judicial affairs and the operation of our system of justice, particularly criminal justice. This is an area of considerable concern. I know that attacks upon the judiciary have been happening since time immemorial, but the area that's of concern is that we are witnessing an insidious and ongoing process of undermining public confidence in both our system and the judicial officers who administer it. And in addition, it's not just the fact of the attack, it is the source of some of the attacks. The Australian community needs a strong, independent and competent judiciary which is fully accountable and in which the public has confidence. We are trying to inform the community more than ever about our work through the internet, media liaison and education programs. But more is needed. Politicians and the media should recognise the need for public confidence and, when appropriate, be willing to promote public confidence in the judiciary and their system. This is an important area for attention by both. It is positive support when it is deserved. Don't tell me it's never deserved. It is positive support which will play a very important role in maintaining that essential public confidence. Now, I do not suggest for one moment that individual decisions, judges or the system should be immune from criticism. Nor am I suggesting you withhold it or temper it when it is justified. The operation of the courts in public, the giving of reasoned and informed criticism are all healthy aspects of our judicial system and the wider democratic processes. But the criticism should be informed and balanced. That is all we are asking. It should not be elevated into an attack upon the system generally when there is criticism of an individual sentence. Nor should criticism in an individual sentence, for example, descend into a personal attack upon the judicial officer concerned. Now, having mentioned the negativity, I agree that it's not all a one-way street. Significant sections of the judiciary have negative attitudes to the media. And so there needs to be an understanding in both directions. Judicial officers need to understand the role of the media and to be willing to facilitate a greater degree of assistance than perhaps has occurred in the past. Journalists face a difficult job. We need to try and help them. They have time limits, are often confronted with large judgments which are difficult to read, and they do not have time to read them. Perhaps we should make greater use of summaries. Clearly we need to provide more assistance, and I need to add to that by saying that in the cases to which Grant referred earlier, the large cases, we set up a focal point for media inquiries. And it worked well. The media were given pretty clear directions, I think, about what they could and could not do. And in the main, there was cooperation throughout. I have absolutely no criticism of the media's behaviour vis-à-vis the court during those trials. We have significant interests in common. I hope that in the future the constant negativity can be replaced by informed criticism and healthy respect. Now perhaps that's a forlorn hope because we'll never agree entirely, but I am confident that there is one thing we do agree on, that whatever is done should not undermine the fundamental right of every accused person, regardless of the charge, regardless of their personal circumstances, and regardless of their ethnic background and religious beliefs, to a fair trial. That right should never be undermined. And it is the responsibility of the entire community to ensure that that right is maintained regardless of the charge and regardless of the personal circumstances of the alleged offender. The court is the instrument of the community for this purpose. But you, the media, and the politicians are also part of the community, and a very significant part because you possess the capacity to undermine this fundamental right. It would indeed be unfortunate if media organisations and politicians possessing such power took the view that they should be unrestrained by community interests or interests of those within the community which are in conflict with their own popular causes. Of the future, very briefly, the internet is already a problem. In fact, it's an offence, I think, in two states, certainly one, perhaps two, to access the internet, that's for a juror, during a trial. I firmly believe that judges have to tell jurors at the beginning that they must not look at the internet to see if they can access any information. When they are told the consequences, and I've seen this happen, when they are told the consequences, and use the example in New South Wales of the jurors who went out and visited the scene at night, the offender had been given, I think, 50 years or something close. The conviction was set aside and the whole thing had to be done again. When you explain that to jurors, you can see the light dawn and they take their responsibilities very seriously. So we have to deal with that. Just like we have to deal with people. Is that a message to me? It sounded like Morse code. Cameras in court need very careful consideration. I know there's a bit of a push for this. We need to remember that witnesses are ordinary people who, through no fault of their own mostly, and certainly through no desire of their own, find themselves under the spotlight in court. Some, of course, enjoy it, but the vast majority find it traumatic to varying degrees. And witnesses are coming along to do the best they can to remember what happened and what was said. We should try to avoid exacerbating the pressure under which they are already working, and cameras in court undoubtedly create a significant risk in this regard. On the other hand, when it comes to delivering pre-prepared judgments and sentencing remarks, I do not see any cogent reason why, if the media is interested, cameras should not be permitted into the court. It might be a bit of a difficulty if you come to talk about magistrates and their daily work, but that's an area that could be investigated. And finally, I saw an article the other day suggesting lawyers for the parties should be able to talk to the media during trials because they will be able to provide the community, and I quote, with a much better understanding of how the legal processes work in a serious criminal case by explaining each day what went on in court. Yes. Even you, who undoubtedly would love to be able to get to them each day. Graham, you'd love it, wouldn't you? Yeah. Even you know it wouldn't be used for that purpose at all. The dangers associated with that proposal are obvious. We should not go down that slippery path. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. I think one of Brian's... Yes, we'll take some questions first. I was going to recall some of your football days. But no, we'll take questions first. Yes, some questions, please, from the floor. Microphone up the back.
None? Good.
Just the microphone up the back. Oh, it's coming around to you.
I'm just interested in what level of traditional physical punishment is acceptable under the one law before you take any consideration at sentencing, given that we don't actually have any sort of guidelines. We haven't been given any guidelines today on what constitutes a physical punishment that is acceptable.
Good question. I'll use an example. Spearing in the thigh. I heard determined in a case that that was unlawful because you could not consent to grievous harm. That clearly involved, in my view, a risk of even death. On the other hand, if somebody said, look, we're going to beat him, give him a bit of a hiding around the rear end with a twitch, which is something I grew up with anyway, and he consents, the offender consents, I'm saying he for present purposes, consents to that, I don't see a problem with it at all. We need to avoid being paternalistic about this. So you can consent to a certain level, but no one has yet had the occasion to draw the line.
Even if those certain levels are not acceptable in Anglo-Saxon law, for instance, if someone was to switch someone else, an Anglo-Saxon switching an Anglo-Saxon, they would end up in court charged with assault.
No. That's the point. You're talking about the consent of the... In this instance, the consent of the victim to being switched.
Right.
So there is no offence. If I consent to you giving me a few twitches across the back with an apple stick, that's why I grew up an apple orchard, that's why I thought of that. Actually, they sting like hell. But if I consent to that as an adult, that's not an offence. So that would be all right. And there is that sort of level can be.
Thank you.
Is that made further complex by the cultures of... Hi. we've got a very complex culture in terms of immigrants, various backgrounds. Does that also apply to immigrant cultures, taking that into account?
Yes, it is.
That's when I was talking...
I used the example of the insults. That's where insults to, in certain terms, to an immigrant might have no impact on you at all, that type of insult. But it can be very crucial in explaining why someone from another country reacted in a particular way.
And it applies to violent assaults as well as insults?
It applies to violent assaults in the sense that it is a factor to be taken into account. How much weight you can give it will depend. If the violent reaction is to cause really serious injury, it may not be able to be given much weight at all. It is simply an explanation. On the other hand, if the reaction is to slap you across the face, then you probably give it considerable weight. So it's a matter of balancing the two out.
Just one follow-up to that. We're from the advertiser, by the way. Given that sort of thought, then, would you be willing to consider a justice system where if a Chinese offender was publicly shamed as is part of their culture, that would be something to take into consideration when sentencing that Chinese offender?
We already take into account public shame. I mentioned it, I think.
I meant the more specific, traditional form of
yes.
it.
I do not see any reason in principle why if a member of the Chinese community has been subjected to public shame, we need to be careful about what's involved in the public shaming. I'm not going to have people put in the stocks. But if, in fact, they are shamed within their community by what they have done, I do not see in principle why we can't take that into account. Because it doesn't matter who it is, what community they come from. If a person has committed an offence and it caused, perhaps it's attracted large publicity, and so they are shamed in their community, the wider South Australian community. Let's assume for a minute that the governor or someone like that, Large wouldn't do that, but someone in a public position commits an offence. They are shamed by the publicity that comes with it. That is a punishment in itself, and you take it into account. How much weight you give it is the...
Just wanting to ask you how South Australia compares with other states in terms of protecting people here from discrimination. And what do you think has changed here since your review in 1994?
I'm going to confess two things. One is you really are putting me on the spot on the question of policy, and I don't think it's appropriate for me to answer. Secondly, I've lost track a bit since I did that review in 1994, and so I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment. I'd love to comment on what they did with the review immediately after I gave it, but I won't. You'd better ask them that.
Some more questions. Pass the parcel.
Your Honour, my name's Andrew Dowdle from ABC. I was just hoping to ask you a question on a slightly broader scale than the Indigenous issue. We hear every day, as you would in court, offenders being sentenced who have a history of child sex abuse as children. Is this the greatest contributory factor that we face as a justice system towards, offending 15, 20 years down the track?
It's an area of very grave concern. I think you'd need to ask a psychiatrist about the influence of abuse as a child upon that victim becoming an offender. I can say to you that there are a large number of sexual assault cases that come through the court, criminal courts, where the offender was in fact abused as a child. I'm talking about males. There's no quit male offenders. That is a factor that exists, and it is an area of grave concern.
And my further, excuse me, my further question was, does the judiciary have any role at all to play in this, as far as addressing these problems at its source, or is it a problem for government and government agencies?
We really can't address anything at its source in reality. We're at the tail end of the process. By the time people, particularly in the Supreme Court, by the time people get to us, all of these social problems that they've been living with for years have had a pervading influence. We really are trying at the blunt end to do something about it, to give them the opportunity, well, one, to punish, to protect the community, but three, to try and create opportunities for rehabilitation. So we really are at the end of the process, and that's why you'll find me and other judges emphasising the need to attack the root causes, which starts with the community as a whole, led by the politicians, the governments.
One up the back, please.
Hi, Verity Edwards from The Australian. With Snowtown suppressions, I understand that the appeals process has finished, but please correct me if I'm wrong. Will you review many of the suppression orders that are still underway?
I won't. I'm in the wrong state now. But if suppression orders are made, then it is open to the media at the conclusion of all the appeals and everything else to apply to have them lifted. I realise that's a practical difficulty, but I think we should appreciate that the Snowtown matter was rather exceptional for its volume, and it did skew the figures in South Australia. Those cases come along occasionally, but the vast majority of cases, there are very few suppression orders, and most of them are lifted by the judge once the information is out there in front of the jury. Most of them. But yes, they could be lifted now if someone made an application.
Chief Justice, my name is Ross Lemerson from The Advertiser. Just wondering, you've spoken a lot about, I guess, importing customary law into our law. Are there signs of some recognition of decisions in our law going the other way? Is there some recognition of precedent?
Is there recognition within customary law of the wider law?
Yes
there is. I think I mentioned that there are many communities that I know of across the territory, and I'm sure this applies across Australia, who have modified their customary law punishments so that they actually comply with the wider law. So it is happening, they are working at it, no question, it's working both ways. It's evolving and they are modifying their laws.
In that case, what sort of, appreciation do we give of that change and perhaps that precedent within white law?
We probably don't give enough credit to them for that. That's why I mentioned it today. I think it's a very important matter that the communities are working. There are people out there who are doing a lot of work trying to reconcile the two laws. And in fact, that was part of the process of this group being invited to Elko Island, was that very process of those people were reaching out to members of the legal community and the politicians and saying, come over here, we want to teach you about our laws. And we actually want to work together. We want these laws to be reconciled. That was a very important initiative, a great move on their part.
Your Honour, Colin James from The Advertiser.
Hello, Colin.
Thank you for a wonderful speech. That was very interesting. Thank you.
You've
presided over three of probably the biggest cases that we know of, Von Arnim, Snowtown and Bradley Murdoch. I'm just interested in knowing which one was the hardest for you and probably the most challenging. If you just give us a bit more of a personal insight on what it's like to be a judicial officer actually presiding over those sort of cases.
Snowtown was the hardest, without doubt.
And
the others were difficult cases, but Snowtown just by the nature of it and the sheer size of it was plainly the hardest.
And what happens on a personal level for a judge who actually has to listen to the evidence that gets presented in those sort of matters? We know Bon Arnhem, it would have been pretty horrific, and Snowtown certainly, I think, pushed all boundaries. And then with Murdoch, it certainly wasn't a pleasant case. Well, what's the personal toll of a judge?
I think you'd better ask my wife and my children about it. I can remember when the Bon Arnhem trial was on, I think my son was about 15. And he'll tell you he got absolutely hammered about where he went and so on. And that case, I think, opened a lot of eyes about areas of our community that we weren't aware of. As to a toll, look, difficult cases do take their toll on judges in various ways, and it's a matter of the individual concern. It's part of the reason why those who have practiced in the criminal law as barristers and then become judges have perhaps an upbringing in that, and it's a bit like the surgeon who's got your heart out there and he's trying to put another valve in. And at that particular moment, how'd your golf go? Bloody hell, I spent most of the day in the bunkers. Now, if you were awake as the patient, you'd be saying, pay attention to this, right? The reason he's doing that is because he's treating, or she, is treating the very seriously, but objectively, and removing the trauma of working on the heart from the mind. And so judges and barristers who practice in the criminal law tend to do the same thing. You try to approach him in a very clinical, objective way. Snowtown was a bit different. That needed some extra care in terms of how we dealt with the staff, treating the jury, everybody involved. It naturally created a strain and needed careful attention. But as to how it affected me personally, no, Lee's not here, so you can't ask her, thank goodness.
Just one more, thanks, Jessica.
Your Honour, Jessica Adamson from Channel 7.
Yes,
can I ask, do you agree with the AMA's claims of institutionalised racism within the health system in the Northern Territory?
I really can't comment on that. One, I wouldn't know. Secondly, it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment as such a broad proposition. Thirdly, though, I will make this comment. In my relatively short time, and it is a short time I've been there, in my relatively short time, I've seen in the Territory a huge amount of goodwill and a large number of people working their butts off in the city, in Alice Springs and in Darwin, in a whole range of areas to try and help the problems and the Aboriginal people and their communities. I've seen people out in those communities who are working their butts off. They are not racist. Now, I don't know where the AMA gets the idea of institutionalised racism, and I can't comment on their sources. All I can say is that in the health system and everywhere else, there's an enormous number of people who are busting their guts to try and help. They are not racist. They are down there, out on the ground, doing the work. They are the people we should be learning from. It's all very well for me as the Chief Justice to pay a visit, and I've paid a visit to a number of communities, to pay a visit and to talk to people. I get an inkling of what's going on. And it's all very well for politicians to arrive on the plane and their big white four-wheel drive, get out, be treated to a special tour, visit a second community, all done in a day, or maybe two, and then fly back to their capital cities and say, we've got the answers. This is what we'll do. I'm not pointing the finger at anyone in particular. I'm just saying that's the fact of life. You cannot get to understand it unless you're on the ground doing work. And there are all these people out there who are on the ground doing an enormous amount. And that they don't get enough credit and they are not consulted enough about what should be done. Sorry, that's a long answer to your question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian, for, as I say, a very fascinating and thought-provoking speech today. When I saw Darrell Warren earlier, an avid Sturt supporter he is, sort of reminded me that Brian Martin was, of course, a member of a string of premiership sides for Sturt. And may I remind you, I think I was talking to one of your former teammates recently who said that back in 1965, as a mere article clerk, you volunteered your services to defend him in an SANFL tribunal hearing. He subsequently got four games and said your career would go nowhere. Well, how wrong he could be, and you get the feeling that Brian Martin's career has still got a long way to go yet. Please put your hands together for us. A little bit of red there to take back. As a former board member, I think that was fairly predictable. Okay, just before we move on, I need someone to draw the raffle. Esther, I knew you'd pay a price for sitting at the head table. Glad you said that. Okay, for the, what have we got there, the cordless phone.